This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Coming up on the program today, in this economy, too much can indeed be too much. Corporate debt today and what we don't know about it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 21st day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are times, and today is one of them, where we need to get down into the nitty-gritty of how this economy works. And we are doing it thanks to one Jerome Powell, the incumbent chair of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. Mr. Powell, Jay, to his friends, gave a speech last night in which he said some things out loud about one of the key lubricants of this economy, corporate debt. Anybody who watches or watches over this economy has been looking now and again at how much companies owe. The ratio of business debt to the entire U.S. economy, that is GDP, is at historic highs. And while Chair Powell did not say that corporate debt is going to bring the whole financial system crashing down around us, he did say that there are some things we don't know about all that corporate debt out there, especially the risky stuff. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Businesses have been taking out more and riskier loans.
The leveraged loan market is larger than it ever has been.
David C. Smith is a professor at the University of Virginia. Leveraged loans are not like regular loans direct from a bank.
Traditional banks will arrange the loans, but then they'll sell off all these, you know, parcel up the pieces of the loans to other institutions.
So banks send those bits of loans right out the door, and with them go bits of risk to other institutions.
Insurance companies, pension funds, even hedge funds now participate to those kind of investments.
Mateo Arena teaches finance at Marquette University. The problem here is that these loans often do not have standards as high as you would find in a regular bank loan.
Basically, the market's so desperate to get some kind of positive return. Interest rates are so low, they're willing to look the other way.
Ken Rogoff is a professor at Harvard. The big question is, who are all these people out there holding these risky loans, and can they handle it if those loans go south?
By and large, if the debt's spread around and some rich tech titan loses their money when there's a default, we really don't care. I think the concern is that there might be some backdoor channel back into the banks.
What if a hedge fund or an insurance company borrowed from a bank and then lent that money to some bad businesses? What if there's a run on a mutual fund that's put money into bad business loans? These are all what-ifs worth asking. Chairman Powell himself said views seem to range from this is a rerun of the subprime mortgage crisis to nothing to worry about here. At the moment, he said, the truth is likely somewhere in the middle. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
A quick detour here to retail, specifically the fast-growing, and that might actually be an understatement, the fast-growing subscription retail industry. Urban Outfitters is launching a clothing rental business called Newly. $88 a month, six items, handbags, shoes, jackets, you know, stuff consumers can hold on to for a month or they can buy. Marketplace's Renata Sago has this look at the risks and the rewards of renting out clothes.
We are living in a fast fashion world, a place where a younger group of consumers takes a one-and-done approach to their looks. They wear it once and don't want to wear it again. That's why 31-year-old Erica Latimer from Chicago has been renting her clothes for the past 5 years.
I barely ever buy clothes anymore.
She's got a heavy rotation of Instagram-worthy looks she wears to work. For $150 a month, she has an unlimited subscription to Rent the Runway.
I've always been interested in just high quality pieces, but I don't have the money to buy it.
There are thousands of consumers like her, and companies like Express and Ann Taylor have jumped in with their own rental services, some as low as $50 a month. According to analysts, the global retail rental market is expected to hit $1.9 billion by the end of 2023. Milton Pedraza runs the Luxury Institute, a research and consulting firm. He says it's a good way for fashion companies to streamline operations.
They're not producing as much, which means they have lower inventory costs. They're not wasting as much. They don't have to discount.
Daphne Howland with Retail Dive adds the model gives retailers insight into consumer tastes without heavy investment into research and development. But one big problem is logistics.
You're basically signing up to agree to returns from the get-go, and returns are a really expensive part of the business.
Rental companies have hired outside logistic firms to help, but Urban Outfitters is expected to build its own logistics division for Nuuly. I'm Renata Sego for Marketplace.
This Tuesday on Wall Street was a, hey, maybe the trade war's really not so bad after all kind of day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. They're shaping up to be a bit of an interagency squabble in the telecommunications industry. We learned yesterday morning-ish that the Federal Communications Commission is probably going to approve the long-awaited $26 billion get-together of Sprint and T-Mobile. The Department of Justice, it was reported yesterday afternoon-ish, might have other ideas. But if it does get done, the companies would become the second biggest wireless company after Verizon. The FCC's approval does require a couple of concessions, including a commitment to help narrow the digital divide in rural America. So Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more now on the benefits and also the challenges of expanding next-generation broadband known as 5G.
With speeds up to 100 times faster than current wireless service, 5G networks have the potential to revolutionize how we use technology. Autonomous vehicles that talk to each other, drone farming.
Next generation telehealth applications like heart surgery from a distance. I mean, just imagine.
Brookings Institution fellow Nicole Turner-Lee says these advances could be particularly beneficial to rural communities where jobs and population have been dwindling.
We've got to do something to break the chain of social isolation and find ways to import services.
According to the FCC, more than 30% of rural residents don't have fixed broadband, and about 14 million don't even have 4G on their phones.
Seriously, there's some people that have no G, right?
And the conditions that led to this digital divide will also make 5G a challenge, says Sharon Strover, a communications professor at UT Austin.
You need to deploy more technology. That's costly and it takes time.
T-Mobile and Sprint promised to build 5G networks for 85% of rural areas in 3 years. Just like other wireless systems, that requires miles of fiber optics and antennas, but more of them closer together.
Without a large customer base, it becomes cost prohibitive.
Dan Hayes, a telecommunications advisor with PwC, says companies would then have to charge extremely high rates to cover their costs in rural areas.
It's a lot of investment in a market where most people are interested in paying less, not more, for their wireless service.
The FCC chairman warned of serious consequences if the companies fail to deliver on their commitments. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Long-haul trucking gets a lot of attention when the subject of autonomous vehicles comes up, as in it's entirely possible a whole lot of long-haul truck drivers might eventually be out of a job. And on that point, a possible milestone today, the U.S. Postal Service, which I ought to tell you is an underwriter of this program, is working with a San Diego driverless technology startup called Too Simple to deliver letters and packages on interstate highways across the Southwest. Marketplace's Jack Stewart has more on what the post office might be up to and what it might eventually mean for all those long-haul truckers.
The USPS trial is just 5 round trips between Arizona and Texas. And if you happen to be on the same road, you're not going to see an empty cab on a big rig. There'll still be a human ready to grab the wheel in case something goes wrong. Chuck Price is running the trial for Too Simple.
Operating long-haul trucks over large distances requires teams of drivers that have to share the vehicle cab for long hours at a time. It's very hard to recruit drivers to do that.
The USPS says its long-term goal in autonomous trucking is to save money and speed deliveries. we're still a long way off from realizing the promise of driverless cars being worked on by the likes of Waymo, Uber, and Tesla. Michelle Avery, head of autonomous and urban mobility for the World Economic Forum, says that trucks might get there sooner because their routes are simpler and more repetitive.
If you can reduce the ask on the computer or the artificial intelligence, then you have a better chance of it coming to market faster. And interstates are great places for that.
The American Trucking Association reckons there's a shortage of up to 60,000 long-haul drivers right now. But its chief economist, Bob Costello, says there are also some regulatory issues to be sorted before robots can take the wheel.
For example, we need a national framework for this technology. Right now, it's a state-by-state basis.
Meanwhile, TuSimple says it'll have a commercial version of its driverless truck technology ready by 2023. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Elizabeth Holmes. No, not that Elizabeth Holmes. She of Theranos infamy. This one was a style reporter for the Wall Street Journal for 10 years, so she knows whereof she speaks fashion-wise. She is also an avid Instagrammer with a particular focus on the British royal family and what they wear says about brand and message and how the royals want to, in a way, sell themselves. It's a story thing she does on Instagram called So Many Thoughts. Now, we have had Elizabeth on the program a bunch of times, so when we found out she was going to be in L.A., we convinced her to swing by. Elizabeth Holmes, I am so glad to have you in the studio.
It's so nice to be across from you, Kai.
I know. It's great to have you here. Tell me what So Many Thoughts is.
So Many Thoughts is my Instagram stories commentary on the fashion and branding of the royal family.
And we'll just get this right out there. You're a royal aficionado. You like to watch them and just you do.
I'm a longtime royal enthusiast.
Gotcha. Enthusiast. Is that what you're called?
Yes.
Okay. All right. But more to the point, tell me what these women specifically, because you do have thoughts on Harry and Will, as it were, but they're not germane, right? You believe that these women are saying something in terms of brand and the marketing of the family and representation, as it were, by what they wear.
Yes. And what I say, you know, a lot of people ask me, why do you care so much about what they're wearing? A lot of times, I mean, most people in this world will never see a royal in person. Mm-hmm. But what we all see the minute they step out of a car is what they're wearing. And they use that as a tool. They use that as a messaging tool to promote certain causes, to lend their support in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I think more so than even celebrities, they see what they wear as a tool to spread the royal brand.
Give me an example, and well, I'm going to give you an example.
Okay.
Meghan and Harry, when they presented Archie, you had thoughts on what she was wearing that day.
Yes. Yeah, so a lot of people thought for sure she was going to wear Givenchy, which is, you know, her sort of go-to designer.
Yeah.
And what she stepped out in was a white trench dress by Grace Wales Bonner, who is a up-and-coming British menswear designer. And that was such a moment to give that worldwide stage to a lesser-known name, right, who is biracial. And I thought that was a wonderful moment.
There's another reason I wanted to talk to you, which is something I saw in So Many Thoughts a while ago. I'm a follower, as you know.
Thank you, Kai.
And it's this thing called dressing for the slideshow, which I didn't understand until I sort of, you know, hung in there with you and tried to get some sense of what it was. What does that mean and why does it matter?
So it's very interesting. When Meghan hit the scene, they announced their engagement and she, you know, was doing sort of public appearances, and you can kind of piece together the style messaging slowly. But, you know, if you look at sort of the progression of her outfits after the royal wedding, it was a series of blush dresses. They sort of built on one another.
Sorry, blush, the color blush? Okay. All right.
Pink.
Okay. Yeah.
If you will. Yeah. And they had striking similarities in sort of their silhouettes and their cuts. And what it became was the brand of Meghan. She's building her brand within the royal family. And if you look back, so more recently, like you said, the birth of baby Archie, when they presented him, she was in a white trench dress.
Right.
If you remember, in November 2017.
I don't remember.
when they announced
absolutely do not.
When they announced their engagement, she was wearing a white trench coat.
Huh.
And so when she got married, she was obviously in a white dress. When they announced the pregnancy, she stepped out in a white dress. So these are four huge moments of her on the stage, all in white. And today, you know, the media puts together slideshows and montages, and it makes for a very aesthetically pleasing presentation, but also gives her sort of these moments where she's defining her style and defining who she is and her brand within the family that are very visible and consistent.
And it is completely intentional.
Oh, yes. That's what I come back to with the royals all the time.
Well, yeah,
there's very little that happens coincidentally or by accident with the royals. This is all sort of managed incredibly carefully and choreographed precisely. And I think that's what makes it worthy of dissection.
Do you suppose anybody styles the queen, or does she just do her own thing?
Well, you know the queen's secret, right? She wears those very bright colors.
Yeah.
She does that for two reasons. One, so that everybody in the crowd can see her from far away.
Fair enough.
And two, so that her security can keep tabs on her. So she wears head to toe in a shade so that when she's up on that balcony in lemon yellow, you person who's way in the back can still see where she is. She also only wears black shoes and carries a black bag.
There,
and when Meghan Markle had her first solo engagement with the Queen, she wore black shoes and carried a black
bag. That's so smart. That's so smart.
It's all intentional.
Elizabeth Holmes, give me the, I should know the Instagram handle off the top of my head. What is it?
E. Holmes.
E. Holmes. She's on Instagram. So many thoughts. Check it out. It's actually completely fascinating.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks a lot for coming in. We put together a couple of slideshows of Meghan Markle's fashion savvy, marketplace.org, to check them out. Coming up,
it's our baby and our passion and our life.
And it's a farm and it's their retirement plan. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 197 today, 0.7%, closed at 25,877. The NASDAQ rose 83 points, about 1%, 77.85. The S&P 500 up 24, 0.8%, 28.64 at the closing bell there. Lots of retail news today, as we said earlier. Some of it, though, not so good. JCPenney shed nearly 7%. Kohl's tumbled 12% after reporting disappointing same-store sales. On the upside, Nordstrom gained about 1% today. Snap, the parent company of Snapchat, got itself a new CFO yesterday. The stock market liked that. Snap stock over 3% to the good today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.43%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We get the minutes of the most recent Fed meeting tomorrow, and it's always good to get more context on what Chair Powell and the gang are thinking. But sharing those minutes, or doing press conferences or interviews and making speeches like the one that Sabri was talking about up at the top of the program, are just some of the ways the Federal Reserve communicates what it does and why. In fact, there is a whole department inside the central bank that is committed to educating the public in other ways, including Federal Reserve comic books.
My name is Jen Kahn.
My name is Anika Pratt.
I'm the Associate Director in Outreach and Education.
And I am the Head of Education Programs at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
So the New York Fed has actually been producing comic books for almost 70 years. In that time, we've published over 24 titles, and each of those titles focuses on different themes of barter, banking, currency. There's even a story of checks in there, and over time, they really progressed to include more information.
Both Jen and I are on a creative project team within the economic education area, and we decided recently to relaunch the series with a modern spin.
The relaunched comic book series includes three books.
Once Upon a Dime,
which focuses on barter, currency, and the development of banking. The Story of the Federal Reserve includes information on the structure and responsibilities of the Federal Reserve System.
And most recently, An Intro to Monetary Policy.
The two main characters are Flora and Glix, and they are aliens from planet Novus. You know, they've started an ice cream store, experienced the ups and downs,
but also travel around and learn and teach about how to keep economies and financial systems stable around the galaxy.
Since we launched the comic books about 3 years ago, we've had a lot of great reaction. We actually had somebody send in a video of their children reading the comic book, and it was two little boys, and they were kind of squished together on the couch, looking through the comic book. The older one was reading the words to the younger one, because I don't think he could quite read yet, but it was kind of cute to see them figuring it out and understanding the forces around them.
I mean, this is definitely one of the more fun projects that we get to work on.
It's a motley crew of economists and educators and illustrators and printers, and it's just so many different types of people from so many different types of backgrounds, and it's a really kind of fun time where we get together and laugh and kind of learn new things ourselves.
Anika Pratt and Jen Kahn there from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. You know about the census, right? The once every 10 years survey of who is here and where they live. There is also, though, something called the Census of Agriculture. It happens once every 5 years. A complete count, says the Department of Agriculture, of U.S. farms and ranches and the people who operate them. And it turns out that the people who operate them are getting older. The average age of American farmers, and this is as of the 2017 Ag Census, is now 57 and a half. That's more than a year older than the 2012 census. Overall, a bit more than a third of American farmers are 65 or older. And as they age out of the fields, those farmers have some big decisions to make. Julia Mitrich has this story of a couple here in California that struck a balance between staying on their farm and the financial calculations retirement brings.
River Hill Farm is nestled below a steep ridge in the Sierra Nevada foothills of Northern California.
I internalized this whole place.
Alan Haight knows his farm by heart, even with his eyes closed.
I know every change in the pitch of the ground. I know where the best soil is. I know where the outcroppings are. I know where the buried rocks are that are too big to move that I avoid hitting with the tractor.
Haight and his wife, Jo McProud, came to farming as a second career in their 40s. Together, they built up a business selling organic vegetables and fruit to folks just down the road in Nevada City. They were passionate about farming, so the watering, the constant weeding, the sweaty summer harvest was worth it. But McProud says it took its toll.
Pushing through those hard times was doable through our 50s. And then as we got into our 60s, just the lack of sleep, the physical stress on our joints. You're not as resilient. Physically, we're getting older.
The couple wanted the farm to continue beyond them, and they needed to draw an income for retirement. But their children weren't interested in farming. So Haight and McProud set out to solve their dilemma by looking for a younger farmer to lease the land. They found Antonio Garza.
I was looking for a long-term opportunity. I'd been farming for, I think it was 7 years at that point.
For now, Garza's got a 2-year lease at River Hill Farm. He has use of the land and equipment. He keeps the profits from selling his crops, and he lives on site. In return, he pays the retired couple rent each month. They all hope this will turn into a longer-term arrangement. And the plan makes financial sense for Garza. Land is so expensive in California, he can't afford to buy a farm. Garza and his partner Dalen Wade crouch in a River Hill farm field, picking broccoli rabe and its lesser-known cousin.
What is it again? The
Spigariello?
Spigariello?
Spigariello rabe. Is also a leaf broccoli, and it's also starting to flower.
The Spigariello greens will garnish pizzas at a local restaurant. Garza has inherited loyal clients and customers that took Haight and McProud years to cultivate. They're content to see their work continue.
It's our baby and our passion and our life. And if we were here watching it wither and die, it would be really heartbreaking. It would be terrible.
Instead, the farm succession's rolling along smoothly. The newly retired farmers live on at their house, overlooking fields and orchards.
I have to say, you know, it's an icy, snowy morning, and looking out and seeing Antonio and Dalen out doing the harvesting the Brussels sprouts this morning, I was pretty happy with my cup of coffee in the house.
When they were farming, Haight and McProud didn't take vacations. Now they get to spend time with their first grandchild. Haight's planning 5 backpacking adventures this summer, and the couple's going on a bunch of road trips. They say they'll cherish time spent together, not talking about the farm. In Sacramento, I'm Julia Mitrich for Marketplace.
Julia's story came to us from the California Dream Project. That's a nonprofit media collaboration out here. This final note on the way out today, in which I am sorry to have to inform you, ladies and gentlemen, that Great Britain's long national nightmare is about to start showing up in your headlines again. British Prime Minister Theresa May said today that she is going to let Parliament vote on whether to hold a second national referendum on Britain leaving the European Union. That's probably going to be in a couple of weeks. Of course, that vote will be tied up in what I think is a fourth vote on May's Brexit plan. So who knows what is going to happen? We were over there for a week in March asking Brits how they feel about the economic impact of whatever is going to happen. Number one, they were just really, really tired of it all. Number two, you can hear all that coverage at our spiffy new website. It is marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 197 today, 0.7%. The NASDAQ up 83 points, that is 1%. The S&P 500 up 24 points, 0.8% there. Our digital and on-demand teams include Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Barbara Platts, Brian Ronahan, Arjuna Soriano, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.